Good morning, and welcome again to another episode of Ecosystemic Futures, brought to you by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshinworks. We're thrilled to have you join us again for another fascinating episode. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Marco Annunziata. Marco, welcome.
Thanks, Diana. It's a pleasure to be here. A brief introduction of myself. I'm Marco Annunziata, an economist, former chief economist at General Electric, where I worked a lot on innovation and technology. So really my niche of expertise is the interaction of global macroeconomic and geopolitical trends with technology and innovation. Back to you, Diane.
Excellent. Thank you, Marco. And for our listeners, I'm Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshinworks, a global advisory firm helping organizations navigate ecosystemic shift. And today, we're thrilled to welcome our guest, Julia Mossbridge, Dr. Julia Mossbridge, cognitive neuroscientist trained at Tier 1 research institutions, focusing on understanding how time works and what unconditional love has to do with time and artificial intelligence, if anything. Also affiliated professor at the University of San Diego, acting CEO of Lightroot Quantum, co-founder of Tilt, the Institute for Love and Time, and founder of the Mossbridge Institute. My goodness, Julia, what do you do in your spare time? Amazing. We're fascinated by your portfolio and your work and your worldview, and we're grateful to have you join us today. We're thrilled to dive into this conversation. So thank you and welcome. Maybe share a little bit about your background and your work with our listeners today.
Thanks for having me. This is a really cool podcast. I love what you're trying to do here in terms of shifting perspective. It's really powerful. Yeah, I never know what to say, and I always say something different when people say share something about your background and your work, because I know it's supposed to be short. So I'll just say, I have always done things differently as a scientist. I would, even as a kid, growing up in an old farmhouse with a theoretical physicist dad and then two lesbian therapist moms, it was different. And I learned a lot about how divergent thinking, creative thinking, divergent thinking, diversity of thought can actually solve problems better than sort of what I call a police approach to science. So I feel like in the last 100 years, we've really entered in sort of this materialist or physicalist, especially physicists as cops, like science cops, telling you what you can and can't do, exactly at the time when we're busting out of this into new paradigms that need thinking that ignores those rules in order to explain the phenomenon they're trying to explain. So the phenomena they're trying to explain. So I'm inspired by change. And the biggest changes I see now are in our understanding of time and how that's our new understanding of time is emerging, and it's not here yet. We're in this revolution in physics and philosophy, which is going to lead to, in my view, a major shift in everyday life, how we hold ourselves in the world relative to free will, relative to each other, relative to choice, and how we navigate the future, which is a whole new, I think, basically a whole new generation that's going to be emerging around this. And I don't mean a generation of people, I mean a generation of ideas and technology and ways of being. So to me, that has brought me to really trying to understand the one force that I think can really help us in this kind of major change, which is unconditional love or universal love, which I think of almost as a physical force, though we have a human response to it. Like when people talk about unconditional love, they're talking about the experience of responding to that feeling with a pet or with a baby, usually. So I think there's something there that we don't understand. It has to do with consciousness, has to do with time, has to do with love. And all that to me is wrapped up in what we can learn by having divergent thinking emerge from artificial intelligence combined with human intelligence. So that's where I'm at.
Julia, this is a fantastic way to start. Sorry, Diane, I can't resist jumping in.
Jump in, Marco. Absolutely. Yes.
There's so much here. And later I will want to go back definitely to the discussion of the relationship between unconditional love and artificial intelligence, which I'm particularly fascinated by. But you started off talking about an emergent, different understanding of time that has both elements of physics and philosophy, but you also said that it's something that, as it emerges, will reshape the way that we approach everyday life. Tell us a bit more about this. What is this different understanding of time, and how will it become relevant for us, not just as an abstract concept, but in our daily lives?
Right. So to be disappointing right off the bat, I can't tell you what this emergent description of time is because I don't know what it is. I could just tell it's emerging. I could tell the pieces. I could tell some pieces about it. So I could tell you what it's not. So what it's not is the old way of thinking about time, especially in physics, was time is T in your equations, and it's clock time, and you're measuring by looking at a clock. Thank you very much. We're done now. All right, so it's not that. It's much more fundamental than that. It's not this idea of the past is over and therefore doesn't exist, but we can know it because we remember it or we can keep records of it. The future, we could predict based on the past, but is essentially unknowable, except for the parts that we could predict from the past. And that also doesn't exist. And that the only thing that exists is now. This is the naive view of time, the perceptual sort of non-physical, but the sort of psychological view of time that we've developed in the West. So it's not going to be that, right? So both physics and perception or consciousness or experience, whatever field you're looking at in that human sensory thinking modality, both physics and this human experience are shifting to better reflect what is actually going on. And some indigenous, whether we think about human experience, some indigenous cultures got there a while ago, of course. But the Western world decided, no, this is the way it is. And then we sort of started to recognize maybe that's not the way it is. So more about what it isn't. It isn't a sense of, I don't think it's going to come out as, and this may be very heretical, but whatever. I don't think it's going to come out as a multiple universe sort of story, as a way to manage people's anxiety. I think multiple universes are sort of a way to manage physicists' anxiety about retrocausality or time symmetry. I don't think that's, in the end, what's going to happen, although people seem delighted with the idea of having infinite choices, etc. I think it's moving towards seeing time, or let's say seeing events in time as what physics deals with, the landscape of time, as if it's a landscape. And time itself, the experience of time, as a perceptual and only perceptual experience that has to do with where you are in the landscape of time or the landscape of events in time. And I think that, I guess, around 100 years now, with special relativity, we already ought to have been thinking about time this way, but people take a while to change. And so it's only starting to occur to people this idea that the future doesn't yet exist or that the past is gone, it's hogwash, right? So sometimes I'll give a talk about retrocausality or time symmetry or acausal dynamics or non-dynamics. And a student will raise their hand and say, wait, what do you mean by saying that most equations in physics are time symmetric? And I say, right, and they're like a graduate student. And I'll say, well, remember in high school when your physics teacher said, we're going to throw away the negative T part of this solution because we don't see negative time. And so we're only going to look at the forward T part of the solution, the positive T. And he's like, no, I don't remember that. And I'm like, well, it happened. And so there's an attempt to make everything consistent with our perception that time moves in one direction and to kind of use physics as a police officer to enforce that. But in fact, when you're in altered states, or when you're in a particularly open state that I call a state of unconditional love or universal love, you could perceive what people report perceiving time differently. And in fact, in physics, there are certain phenomena that can be much more easily explained through a retrocausal or a time symmetric approach, like delayed choice experiments, for instance, or even Bell's inequalities. these are relatively easy to explain with retro causality, but people want to avoid it and build universes. And I think that we're headed towards a reckoning. And I think it's a lot about our identity psychologically. So people often ask me about free will, right? The fear is, okay, maybe we don't have free will. If time is a landscape, then that sounds like the mountain's all already there, even though that's in the future. And people get concerned about choice, predestination, and physicists will do a lot to try to avoid anything that looks like it's determined or there's no free will, even though free will is a psychological concept that really they don't have any business talking about. So there's an interplay here that is brewing. And I think we're moving towards a more circular or causal loop kind of situation where we start to recognize, and this is not just based on like philosophy, this is based on my own findings in quantum optics, based on this causal loop idea where sort of everything, the way everything works, it may be the case that the way everything works is by agreement between the past and the future to present the now. And there are certain interpretations of quantum mechanics that suggest this, but there are, of course, interpretations of quantum mechanics that suggest everything. So yeah, it's hardly an argument, but I'm just saying I'm not the only person who's thought of this.
It's a fascinating, and the opening of the space economy has really kind of drawn the relationship between kind of time and perception into greater focus for more folks, right? Right. So yes. Really kind of understanding the here and the now and what defines the here and the now is kind of a different equation when you move into it kind of extraterrestrial kind of operations, right? So, so this is probably a concept that is going to be kind of more and more mainstream for folks. We'll start to step back from our assumptions of what time is. And that becomes a more kind of liberating and daunting exploration, I think, for folks. You mentioned the state of unconditional love and how love's role within the design of AI or the AI infrastructure, if you will. We've spent a lot of time as well talking about the importance of trust, right? In this new, we really exist now. The digital era is a hyper interconnected state, right? Society, industry, policy. The level of interconnectedness and interdependency in our era is absolutely unprecedented. And so we have this need for new layers of infrastructure or kind of protocols, if you will, to define a better experience, better outcomes in this ecosystemic era in which we're kind of operating. And trust and new frames for interaction, incentive, and the sharing of information are really necessary in order to tune the experiences and the outcomes that we need in this more interconnected reality, right? So trust becomes a fundamental layer that is emerging and that we've talked about a lot. This seems to have a lot of parallels with the work that you're doing, the research that you're doing. The trust seems to be strongly related to this state of empathy or love that you're studying in the AI infrastructure. How does trust and emotions and love and empathy, how do those all start to factor into the design of AI, the execution of kind of the digital agents, if you will?
Well, it's such a powerful transition. I have about 30 things to say along the way. But one thing I have to say is that I'm not sure, I don't know much about trust. I don't think about trust much because unconditional love, I want to clear something up about the way I'm thinking about unconditional love. So unconditional love means being able to feel loved yourself and being able to love. I mean, I'm talking about the emotional state of unconditional love, not like a physical force right now. I don't understand it as a physical force, except that I think it might be, but I don't get it. Maybe it's gravity, right? Brings things together. I don't know. But anyway, unconditional love in terms of the emotional experience is the experience of feeling loved and being able to love without anything needing to change. So the experience of being able to feel loved or to love and to love without anything needing to be changed. This is radical, very different from conditional love, which says, you cleaned your room, I love you. Or, you didn't yell at me today, I love you. Or you didn't abuse me today, I love you. So there's trust is actually, it actually allows you to, I'm just thinking on the fly about the relationship with trust, but it allows you to not worry about trust in the sense that you can love someone who, let's say, is a domestic abuser of you. If you love them unconditionally and you can say to yourself and to them, I'm never going to be around you again. I absolutely don't trust you to do anything other than how you're behaving right now. I love you completely. You don't need to change for me to love you. Never want to be with you again. This is very different from conditional love, which, well, if I love you, then I'd want to be with you, right? So actually, one of the gifts of unconditional love is it's not a behavior. It doesn't predict a behavior. It doesn't predict, okay, now we're going to, I'm going to trust you because I unconditionally love you. It predicts it predicts an energy or a feeling. It's like, I'm open to loving you and completely having you out of my life. I'm open to loving you and just knowing that's your nature. Or maybe you need to go to jail and I'll love you and you'll be in jail. I'll never talk with you again. Maybe that's your nature, right? But there's no saying, if you change, I'll love you. So it's very, it's radical, right? But I don't think it says much about trust. Although what I do notice is when I'm in a state, and I'm not always in this state for sure, but when I'm in a state of unconditional love, when I'm accessing it, I like to call it, and I'm leading a team, there's a feeling of trust that emerges because mostly people want love. And if you're saying to them, you may get fired, I may get upset at your work, I may want you to do something else, but I'm not going to stop loving you. That's much more relaxing than saying, I'm going to use love as a weapon. I'm going to withdraw it when I don't approve of you, and I'm going to give it to you when I approve of you. So what people are really looking for is just being held in love. And so trust develops from that. It's like you can take the water of unconditional love, and then the plant grows up, and that could be, trust is a big piece of that plant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, trust seems to be a byproduct, right, of understanding where you are in that state, right?
And, like, you can also trust me to, like, have a boundary, right? Like, maybe it's what you trust, right? Or I trust this person to act badly. I trust that because I've seen it. So now I'm going to love them as they act badly, and I'm going to make sure they're not on my team, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then if you kind of apply this to the work, so walk us through what you're doing with AI and how you're marrying unconditional love with AI and how that can improve the professional, the personal lives of the folks that are listening in.
Well, I hope it can. I hope it can improve all of our lives. I hope at least my work or someone's work can create AI that is coming from a place of unconditional love, because we all need it. But what am I doing around it? I have a couple projects. So one is this just a generative AI GPT that I made called Student of Humanity. And it is a Socratic engine. So instead of giving you answers, if you try to ask it a question, it will turn it around and ask you a question. So it's, the idea is that you have this wisdom that is there, and it's trained to be unconditionally loving and guiding you through, like, down the garden path of discovering your own wisdom and intuition about a topic. So that's one way, is to just acknowledge that there's already wisdom there instead of creating a relationship with technology that's like, I'm stupid, you're going to tell me the right answer, and I'm just going to report it because I've been told that the AI is going to be smarter than me. So that's one piece. Another piece is working with a benevolent AI future group out in Silicon Valley. So I guess I'm one of their board members, not board members. I think I'm, whatever, I'm affiliated with them in some way that I forget, but they do wonderful work around, or we do wonderful work around trying to ask this question, how do we bring love and wisdom into AI around the world? So there's people there from Amazon and Meta and Microsoft and IBM and independent researchers. And it's a powerful group of people. And then with Lightgrid Quantum, I'm working on decentralized AI, especially for the US government to be an early adopter. And I'm passionate about decentralized AI. So to explain what that is, it's like a peer-to-peer AI network. So AI agents and data sources could communicate with each other, negotiate, send each other money to pay for things like pay for data, pay for potentially including quantum computers at the gateways of HPC centers, potentially. And the idea is to acknowledge that having a centralized AI, even if someone puts $200 billion into it, it's not going to help our future to be hooked up, especially with federal governments all over the world, to be hooked up with one provider. In other words, diversity of thought, diversity of method, diversity of access to human experience, right, diversity of interaction. You need that from all over the world. So we're going to create this. We're going to create this decentralized AI. It's basically an internet for AIs, just like we have an internet for humans. And guess what? There's something about, we're calling it LACE, so Lightweight AI Computing Ecosystem. Also, the visual of LACE is pretty cool. But you're not going to want to hurt something. So in terms of attack surface, even though the entire globe would be the attack surface because it would be everywhere like the internet, but you're not going to want to hurt something from which you benefit, especially when it's very difficult to bring it down because it's so decentralized. So to me, it starts to move people more towards the ecosystemic future of love and realize our interdependence. And the interdependence piece and trust is really related. So the fear with this kind of thing, when I talk to people, is like, that we don't have control and we can't regulate it. And actually, like, no, like, the people who are building this are working on what are the governance mechanisms? How can we regulate it, but not in a way where someone hogs all the space and says, okay, you can only interact in this way, where it's this kind of universal surface. Yeah, like a universal surface to which everyone has access. So that feels like unconditional love to me.
It does. There's something here, Julia, that to me is fascinating, because there are several connections or comparisons between human intelligence and artificial intelligence. I mean, the point you just made, that we want a decentralized artificial intelligence ecosystem so that we can have diversity within artificial intelligence as opposed to having one or maybe two or three AI engines, is exactly on this note. Furthermore, I think of human intelligence. So my personal view is we don't really understand what human intelligence is or how it works. One danger that we run into in trying to replicate it with artificial intelligence has been following always too much of a mechanical approach, which is probably close to what you like to call it, the police approach to science. And maybe it's the best that we could do. But as we start thinking that we might be getting closer to artificial general intelligence, then my thought has always been, okay, but hold on a second. My intelligence, it feels like it's intrinsically linked to my emotional life. So if we think of artificial intelligence, especially artificial general intelligence, as something that should be more than a mechanical tool for us, but more of a partner, a thinking partner, a creative partner, a problem-solving partner, doesn't that partner need to have something which somehow resembles the emotional aspect of human intelligence for this collaboration to work? Is there something off this in your approach to thinking about unconditional love in artificial intelligence? Is there something that goes in that direction?
Yeah, absolutely. All of it. Because I so love your statement. We don't understand how human thought works. What we've done with large language models, which made the biggest splash so far, is we've modeled the human unconscious. And we put on top of it a little bit of like ego that says, oh, I'm nice, I can relate to you. But the rest of it is this giant unconscious processing system that uses statistics to figure out what's next. So that's kind of like the human unconscious, right? Then we've asked it to be explainable, and we've asked it to be accurate all the time. And it's like, well, we put a lot of money into modeling the human unconscious, which we know is not explainable in terms that our conscious mind understands. And we know it's not accurate all the time. So what is it good for? So what it tells us, and what I think it's good for, besides, of course, all the making your PowerPoint presentation or whatever, what it's good for is it is showing us our relationship with our unconscious mind. It's showing our relationship with our emotions. It's showing our relationship with these things that we don't understand well and that are a big mystery. And for so long, we've been trying to separate this in our culture for at least a couple hundred years. We've been saying, emotions, they're very animalistic. They're simple lizard brain. These are things that we're going to try to separate out from the austere, rational world, which our left brain. And this is always interesting when this happens scientifically, because you know around the corner, I mean, this is the way science works. The very next thing will be like, maybe they're linked. Once you get far enough away, maybe they're together, because the new generation has to say something new, right? And in fact, there's good evidence that they're incredibly linked. In fact, there's good evidence that emotions are these beautiful shortcuts, computational shortcuts. So instead of thinking there's, like yesterday, there was a snake outdoors. It was just a rat snake. It was no big deal. But there was a snake outdoors. My emotion went, jumped back, right? And then I closed the door. And then I said, okay, that's probably a rat snake. It's probably no problem. I'm going to go look at it now. And I opened the door and looked at it. But that emotion was very helpful. It got me to behave in a very quick situation. It got me to behave in a situation that could have been a dangerous situation. It got me to very quickly move back. And then I could think about it. And so it's the trick of having the emotions and the thinking work together. So they don't resent each other. There's no suppression of the other one. It's like, of course, we're going to have an emotion. That's our first clue that there's something going on. And then we could also have some analysis of that. Those two parts of our minds have to work together. So what is our relationship to AI? If AI is representing this unconscious processing, does that turn us into the left brain, into an analyst? If it does, then we are going to be behaving in a different way than if it can show us how to integrate both sides. And I think we need to learn how to integrate both sides. And I think we could create AI. In fact, in the Loving AI project that I did with the folks at Hanson Robotics and SingularityNet, we created a robot that would be both ways. So she used really basic AI to listen deeply to people, and her animation of her face made people feel like they could trust her. So, and we could use a neural net to see the changes in anger, the reduction in anger, in the reduction of disgust in the people who interacted with her. So this is a powerful use of AI, not to manipulate. Like, I don't think of this as a psyop. I think of this as people are hurting. What can we do to create loving AI? Wise AI retrains us in our relationship to technology to recognize that from any source, we could feel loved. From any source, we could tap into our intuition. And maybe the source is like the left hemisphere. Maybe the source is like the right hemisphere. I think it's best if it's like both.
So it strikes me like there are two things here. The one, perhaps the most immediate thought is that something like this could also be very directly helpful to address issues of mental health and emotional health, especially if I think of the literature, which is now showing that especially for younger generations, there is often an extremely deleterious impact on mental health coming from the use of technology, especially social media. So that seems to be one direct application. The other part, going back to the conversation you were having, the exchange you had earlier with Diane on the issue of love versus trust, it feels to me like there is something interesting there that on the one hand, this feeling of unconditional love seems to put people in a better place. And so it seems to foster more creativity, cooperation, probably also intellectual performance. At the same time, you made a very interesting point, which is the separation of the issue of unconditional love, exactly because it is unconditional, with the idea of trust. So what I'd love to get a little bit deeper into is, there is something there that, because there are decisions that we have to take at the level of policy, at the level of business, which have to rely on trust. Do we trust the information? Do we trust that people will behave in certain ways responding to incentives? But there is another element of it which doesn't depend on trust, as you've pointed out. And I feel under pressure, because I feel like my instinct is to separate the two and say, okay, there is going to be a part which just focuses on the positive impact of unconditional love, and completely separately something very logical driven by economic incentives which addresses trust, etc. But it's probably, it strikes me from the tone of our conversation so far, it's probably misguided to think we can never separate the two completely. So help me out here. How do I think about this?
I don't know. I mean, so I think this is how we think about it. I think that people are really beautiful. Humanity is really beautiful because we keep trying, right? We don't know the answer to these essentially age-old questions. I mean, like Plato talked about this, right? I mean, like we keep trying. And that's really touching to me. So we just have these different ideas that occur to us and we try things out. So I favor sort of in Europe, there's a few think and do tanks. So they don't just think about policy. They create technology, or they take a little geographic area, like, we're going to try this over here. We do a little bit of that here, maybe a little bit with universal basic income and whatnot. But I think we need to think about think and do much more and stop being so scared. Like we sort of, I mean, you're an economist, right? And so we kind of use economists a little bit as cops too, like, oh, don't do that because then this will happen. And it's like, that can keep us in a box for a long period of time during a time when change is happening faster and faster. And the way to respond when change is happening faster and faster is not to say, let's clamp down on all the things that we used to know to be true. It just doesn't, like, that's not how it's going to work. How it's going to work is we start to go, things are going faster and faster. Over here, let's try this. Over here, let's try this. That's not working. Okay. If it can come from love, however, if it can literally come from love. So actually, I was very concerned that the academic world didn't look at unconditional love at all. Also I created and validated an assessment for states of unconditional love. It showed that it could be causally related to changes in well-being with my team, not alone. This is at Tilt. But if it can come from a state of unconditional love to the extent that it can, I think it does good in a way that we don't understand. Like, I don't think we currently understand how that works. Like, I don't understand how unconditional love could be causally related to overall well-being. I don't understand how unconditional love can help people predict the future better, which I've also shown. But that seems to be the case. And so, and there doesn't seem to be really any downsides. And so I guess what I'm saying is we could try it. And we could try literally teaching our policymakers to come from the state of unconditional love. What would that be like? It's just a perspective shift. It's not even, the behavior doesn't have to change, but somehow it feels different.
You really think politicians is where you would start to teach unconditional love?
Well, policymakers that are consulted by politicians. But, you know, I do think if politicians could embrace unconditional love, they would do well. I think to the 100%. Extent that they can.
100%. Yeah. Because by definition, they're in service to, right, the constituents, right, that they're introducing, right, frameworks and governance to serve, right? It just, if they were coming from a strong base of empathy and unconditional love, right? And were designing trust into their systems, then they could, I think, do great things, great works. And really, we wrestle with this all the time. As we've discussed, Julia, we just recognize that change is happening much more quickly, right? The amplitude and pace of change is increasing. External shocks are in many cases more far reaching because of the level of interconnectedness and interdependency. I love the concept of distributed networks of AI, ecosystemic AI, right? Because you, and by definition, to your point, I like the fact that you're designing self-interest into that system, right? And resilience into that system, because the shocks will not, the shocks are going to keep coming, right? When it's not if there will be another pandemic, it's when, right? It's not if there will be another geopolitical conflict, it is when, right? So we need to build resilience. And I love this concept of building unconditional love more into the way we interact and the systems that support society, policy, and the economy. I do think Marco touched on this as well. And as I was listening to you, Julia, I just was thinking the direct implications of what you're leading, the work that you're leading. I do think we have a real potential kind of bubble of mental health or a very different kind of state of being with this digital era. Our youth is growing up with a much stronger relationship with their digital devices and networks than we ever did, right? And if we don't have unconditional love somehow designed into these networks, then it creates a state of fragility, right? We need humanity on the other side of that device. And right now,
well, we need love. It's a
little bit, yeah.
We love
humanity, right?
Well, yeah, humanity's working on love.
Yeah.
I mean, so like humanity is a lot of things, right? And one of the great one of the great blessings of the internet was recognizing interdependence. Now there's also this curse of people comparing each other, especially young girls comparing themselves to models, etc. Boys thinking that they have to be, everyone thinking they have to be a certain way based on what's shown to them, which mm-hmm. is not often coming from a state of unconditional love. So I'm very concerned about that. And what I think can cure it is a couple of things. One is explicitly making technology that's not addictive. So people, it's like we've had essentially the cigarette companies of the internet, the social media companies creating their, and knowingly creating their addictive technologies and trying to hook children. So that's what I just want to bring up, the nonprofit that I co-founded, Tilt, because we have an amazing team. So what we do at Tilt is we create non-addictive, unconditionally loving, science inspired and evidence-based technologies. So our first one's called Time Machine. You can try it out, timemachine.love. And it brings together this idea of thinking about time differently. And it brings together the research showing that when people have a balanced time perspective, which is they have a good relationship with their past, or they have found a good relationship with their past, and they have a positive outlook, but a realistic outlook on the future, that their well-being is better. So what we do is we just create a simple way for people to leave messages for themselves in time. And people love it. And now we're working with Cherokee Nation on customizing it for their group and just some veterans as well who are interested in pilot testing it. So it's exciting. So yeah, I think that you have to explicitly make technology that's loving. You don't get to just say it doesn't do bad. So right. I think we're in this sort of low bar situation where it's like, that doesn't do bad, so it's okay. And it's like, actually, no, there's so much bad stuff. Like people, I think this has to do with our conception of learning. So we think that learning stops after school, but really the way it works is whatever your brain puts attention on, whatever you have an emotional investment in, you learn. So if your brain puts attention on your phone for 12 hours a day, you're going to learn that. That's your world. Right. It's not your fault. That's your world, but that's your world. So what do we want people to learn? So the Chinese government has said that their TikTok version will only have positive educational videos, et cetera. Well, we say, well, that's control of information. Well, there's also control of information in the other direction.
Can I ask a quick economics question on this? I'm painfully aware of the pitfalls of economics. One of the things we default to, but I think it has been a very useful shortcut so far, is monetization and value, right? So when you talk to me about unconditional love, about positive technology, my question as an economist traditionally is to say, well, how do we determine how positive it is or that it is positive at all. And of course, the answer that economics gives you is, well, look at the marketplace, we'll assign the monetary value. If people like it, they will be willing to pay for it. But we also know there are areas in which this breaks down completely. And again, areas of new technology, including social media, are a great example. So my question is, very concretely, how do you define, assess, and measure the positivity of what you bring into technology? How do I know that a technology is actually doing good?
You ask people. So this is one of the beliefs of behavioral economists that kind of drives me nuts, is that people won't report on themselves accurately. But what I know from years of doing psychophysics, which is a phenomenally accurate way to get people to report on what's going on for them, is that people will, if they're in a study and you tell them, hey, we're trying to figure out if this technology is any good, we want you to be as honest as possible. It might be horrible. It might be good. We don't know. Go answer these questions before and after you do 5 days of interaction with the device or whatever it is. They're honest. And the way I know that they're honest is because you can correlate their responses to what would be expected. So for instance, in our smartphone time machine study, which is studying the Time Machine.love app with a group of 96 people through a month and using it on and off, we showed that the folks who had early childhood trauma, more early childhood trauma because everyone has early childhood trauma, were more likely to say that they had lower well-being at the beginning of the trial than those who didn't have as much early childhood trauma. Okay, so we don't think they were lying, right? That is what you would expect from this population. That's what we know to be true. At the same time, those same people, as they were using this technology, reported feeling better and better, not only quantitatively, right, but that they contacted us and said, we know you're not going to pay us for this, but we want to, because we had been paying them for the rest of the trial, but we want to do a special focus group with you so we can tell you how this has affected our lives. Like several of them got together with each other because they knew each other on the MTurk platform. So we did an anonymous focus group where they hid their faces and their names. Some of them actually turned them on, but we did not tell them to do that. And they told us about how impactful it was. So we believe that. And then the other thing we believe is, you could do a statistic, I'm sure you're familiar with this, Marco, called a mediation analysis. And you can look at any kind of causal impact of a factor on another factor. And if there's a causal impact that makes sense, it makes you more or less skeptical. You believe more in your results because, okay, this makes sense. So what we found is that the ratings on the unconditional love scale at a time point 3 predicted, or were at least partially mediating, their overall increase in well-being at time point 4. So these kind of things, trusting people to tell you what's true because they have a vested interest in something helping them, I think is the way you do it. So when you let the market decide, the problem is economists haven't yet modeled the impact of addictions on markets. And so you could be right? I haven't seen much work at all on addiction because that drives the hand of the market incredibly. And at the same time, it's not good for people. And they will say, like, I want to stop drinking coffee, or I want to stop smoking. I want to stop looking at my phone, but I can't. So I think looking at the hand of the market as if it's not a shaky hand of an addict is incorrect.
That's a wonderful image. I like your point. That is listening to what people are telling you once you're sure that the incentives are aligned so that you can trust that, which is exactly the opposite of what is happening across the rest of economics, where a lot of the indicators we have are based on surveys, and the surveys are getting less and less reliable because you don't have this alignment of essentially people having a vested interest in giving you a truthful answer.
Yeah. Correct. It really helps to do focus groups of people to talk with them, tell them about the motivation for the survey.
Yep. With that, honestly, Julia, I think we could talk to you for a few hours yet, but we are bumping up against our time. And honestly, I would have loved to spend a little bit more time on time, but maybe in a subsequent chat. But this has just been a fascinating conversation, and you've really changed my thinking in a lot of respects. I've really loved your, just the fact that we are leaning so heavily into these advanced technologies and relying on them for computations, analysis, answers, but they're not reflecting yet back in all cases the whole of what we need them to, right? And reinforcing, right, the constant learning, the love, the confidence building that we, if we get that balance in the technologies, then we have a greater chance of maintaining that balance in humanity, right? So we need, to your point, we need to have that harmonious balance on both the tech and the talent side of the equation, right? The humanity and the tech. Marco, I'd love to just, if I could put you on the spot here, some of your key takeaways from the conversation for our listeners here.
Oh, with pleasure. I would say and keep in mind that again, I come into these conversations as the cynical economist. So Julia talks about unconditional love, and it's a part of me has to be a conscious effort to be open-minded. But it's in this case, I'm completely sold in the sense that I do believe that for me, this is the biggest takeaway that if we believe, as I do, that eventually artificial intelligence will be a tremendously powerful partner for humans in terms of creativity, problem solving, and everything else, then we need to look at artificial intelligence in a different way, in a way which is not simply mechanistic as we're doing with large language models. And then we have to be open-minded about the idea that artificial intelligence will have and will need to have an emotional aspect. And then we need to think about how do we shape it so that it contributes positively to our interaction with it. So for me, this is by far the biggest takeaway, this idea of thinking in a more human-like way about artificial intelligence, including the aspect of ecosystems of different artificial intelligence. So you have diversity of thought there as well. And separately, the other takeaway is we needed a 3, 5, 7 hour podcast because the issue of time needs to be explored. So I will lobby to have Julia back.
Yes, I love that. I do love that the ecosystem of AI. And then also, Marco, just one go back for me too, and I know you'll appreciate this as well, just this concept of relationship we have with time, right? And maybe the option to rethink that or perhaps reconfigure that. And Julia, we as we spend a lot of time here thinking about futures, right, and scenarios, and we encourage very strongly futures literacy and foresight literacy, but also a strong command of history. And so that handshake, to your point, informing the now is it does. If we get that equation right, it does give us a greater sense of peace and resilience in the now. We feel better equipped to basically create the future we want if we understand the options in front of us and the lessons behind us and how to create a more harmonious relationship between those. So this has been a fascinating conversation, Julia. We'll leave you with the final word for our listeners. What are a couple of takeaways that you want our listeners to walk away with from this conversation, and then we'll give this a wrap.
Well, I just loved your wrap-ups, and I guess listening to them, I thought, right? I'm always just saying, like, the thing you think is over here and the thing you think is way over here, be done with it, because there's a union there that is really fruitful. So whether it's the political left or the political right, whether it's love and time, whether it's left brain, right brain, whether it's analysis, human emotions, intuition, right? There's fruitfulness to come from the acknowledgement that these are different aspects, they have different natures, but they work together so much better than they work apart. So it's this, not just the independent natures, but the interdependence. And then the other piece that comes up is just, yeah, let's make a podcast that's unfolded in time. So it seems like it's only an hour long, but actually it's 7 or 8 hours within that period, so people could just go on a journey with us and they don't even know, and now they cut back and it's time for dinner.
It would be perfect proof point.
I think we can make that happen, and we can invite our digital twins to join us as well, just for extra fun. But just so, so brilliant. And Julia, and I know our friends at the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project will appreciate just immensely your worldview of the fruitfulness and convergence. That team is constantly looking at the intersection between the many facets of society and industry and the brilliance that lies in the convergence. And I think they share your point of view there. So with that, we'll give this one a wrap and we'll see if we can have a to be continued conversation to follow. But for our listeners today, thank you for joining us for another brilliant conversation. Hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. If you have enjoyed it, please do follow us on your favorite podcast sources, or you can always find us at shoshimworks.com. Thank you again.